Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the World of Ink Network, founded in 2011 by Virginia Grenier and Marcia Cook. Their vision was to start a radio show that helped writers reach their dreams. The World of Ink has a wonderful group of hosts who are dedicated to delivering shows to entertain and inspire listeners. The World of Ink Network shares resources that introduce tips, products, and services to help strengthen, support, and challenge those who love writing and the written word. Their hope is to bring not only authors, illustrators, and publishers together, but screenwriters, directors, and producers. New to the network will be a variety of special shows, bringing not only entertaining shows, but informative discussions on timely subjects. To learn more about us, go to www.worldofinknetwork.com or visit us on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you for your support and enjoy the show.
Hi, everybody. It's Marcia Cook, and it's A Good Story is a Good Story on the World of Ink, and we have a great show. Jack Remick is our guest, and it's not our guest, it's my guest. Virginia won't be at the show. And Jack's been on many times. He's great. I'm just going to give a few messages, and then I'm going to bring Jack right out because he's got so much to talk about, and it should be a very interesting show because we're going to talk about a lot of different subjects. The good news is also that we have some of our hosts coming back in the fall. Candy O'Donnell will be back with the show. Willow Cross, Jennifer Malone Wright, and Elizabeth Black has got a show. Actually, she's starting October 6th. And Willow and Jennifer will be in October, and or they may be next week. She wasn't sure yet. And I'm here doing shows, and Virginia will be doing some shows, so it's going to be a great year. And we're going to – let's see if I forgot anything else. Anybody that wants to call in, they can call at 714-242-5259, and the chat room is open if anybody would like to chat. Sometimes we don't have as many chats, you know, because sometimes people cannot open the chat room. So if you go on Blog Talk Radio and you put in World of Ink, you should be able to find our show. I have different links in various on Facebook pages, Twitter, so you can just click on, and they have made it where now you see just something to click on, and then you can join. Otherwise, you can people listen to the show on archives, which is that's always a good way because they're always on, and even shows that we've had months and months and months ago, you'll always be able to find them on the World of Ink or on Blog Talk Radio. And so I will bring out Jack. Jack, hello, Jack. How are you?
Hi, Marcia. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good. I'm so happy to have you because it's always such a lively discussion.
As you were running that list of guests who were going to be on or how the show was going to run, I was remembering that you had Eleanor Parker Sapia on.
Yes, and I've been keeping up with her.
Well, you know, her book, A Decent Woman, has been really garnering some really good reviews and a lot of high finishes in competitions. And she's working on another book. So if you're
yeah, she said she would be on. She said
back,
she was going to
you know.
Get in touch with me. Yeah, because I have been talking. You know, I've had some conversations with her, and she knows she's welcome to come on at any time. So
I will.
You know, she said she's going to contact me. Oh yeah, the people that I just announced, those people are having shows. So they're having their own show on World of Ink. And I'm always available for if anybody is listening and they want to be on the show, I can either have you on a show alone or I can, if you've never been on, I can put you in with some other people so you'll be more comfortable. I have shows on every subject. So as we all know, I had a show about 2 weeks ago on abuse, and we're going to have another one on abuse, and we're going to have more sizzling hot romance shows. Bethany Cross and myself are going to start those in November. So we're going to have a lot of different shows.
Yeah,
there's so many things. And Eleanor, yes, I definitely want to have Eleanor. She knows that, though. And you have so much going on. I don't know where to begin with you, but I know you have some subjects that you want to talk about. So let me tell everybody just something about you if they haven't already known you, but most of them do that listen to this show.
Well, I write novels and poetry and short stories, have a couple collections of things. I think I have 16 books out there now of various kinds.
Great.
Two or three volumes of poetry, a couple anthology things like that, short story collections. The California Quartet I just finished, I forget when that was. Maybe, I can't remember, Marcia, but sometime this year I finished the California Quartet.
You have a lot of them right there. You know, that's what happens when you write so much and are doing so many things. It's like you do a project, okay, on to the next. There you go.
Yeah. And then I've been doing quite a few readings now, trying to, bring as much poetry and prose as I can to, to the world, so to speak. I like to read. I think one of the things that I have figured out about reading in public is that, I have an idea that you don't really know what a piece is about until you've read it in public 10 or 12
That's
times.
That's true. I'd agree with that,
Yeah, because you get, each time you perform it, you see something, you go back and you make changes. And then when you're in high performance mode, which I consider as close to the creative state as you can get and not be actually writing, you actually bring a whole new dimension to the piece. And so I like to get out and read as much as I can. Unfortunately, what I'm finding is that a lot of readers, people who are poets or reading from novels and stuff, they're really good at reading all the words, but they don't read any of the music. Now, what does that mean? I had a composer friend named John Barrell, who was a composer, a pianist, conductor. He was involved in all kinds of things. I was playing for him a recording of some French pianist doing some four-hand stuff, and he listened to it, and I said, "Well, what do you think, John?" And he said, like so many of the young, technically perfect pianists, they play all the notes and none of the music. Now, the thing really works in words, too, because if you just read the words, you can get flat, have any music in it. What do I mean when I talk about music in poetry and music in prose? Well, one of the things that most readers do not pay attention to is what I call cadence. In music, there's a concept called rubato, where you change the pace or they change the rhythm. You change
right.
First you play fast, then you play slow, and within the dynamic markings of the composer, you make variations. And a lot of writers and readers don't do that. And this bothers me because a lot of people think of poetry as boring. If you listen to the words, yeah, maybe. But if you infuse some of the music behind those words into a reading, you actually produce a work of art that has at least two dimensions. It has the word dimension and it has that ineffable emotional dimension that you get from the words. Let me give you an example. One of the poems that I read sometimes in public is called Breathless. And it's about, being a poet, coming of age poet in the beat age. And if I read the words, it sounds like this. I took first communion on the steps of the jazz cellar, too young to buy my own booze, too dumb to steal it. I heard Rex Roth rip the nation naked over the beat of conga drums and horns crystal in the night. It's there. There are all the words, but to me it's boring as hell. Now when I read it, trying to get to the music in it, I think about varying the speed of delivery. I think about singing the vowels, holding the vowels when I turn the line. So it comes out something like this. I took first communion on the steps of the jazz cellar, too young to buy my own booze, too young to steal it. I heard Rex Roth rip the nation naked over the beat of conga drums and horns crystal in the night. And you can hear there's a big difference.
Do you ever watch when you were reading that, and do you ever watch The Affair? It's on Showtime. The Affair. The Affair?
No.
Okay. Now, it's called The Affair. They have a song that they sing at the beginning of the show, which is in that type of a rhythm. Mm-hmm. And it's called The Affair. It's not on now, but if you have, I think it's on demand, and they have a, it's a very strange sounding song, mm-hmm. but you start to love it. And when you listen to it, so next time we talk, listen to that or even email me when you hear it, because that, just what you were doing now is kind of like this, the way they do the song.
Excellent.
And it's so
great.
Entertaining because it's so different. And it, you know, because you hear a lot of songs, but it's done just like that. So maybe they actually know the same thing you do, because that it sounds different.
Well, you know,
it's like audiobooks. The same, that's how audiobooks, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I
well,
like audiobooks a lot.
Yeah.
I think you get more out of them because you're listening to it.
Let me run back to this thing that, you know, that's not just in poetry you can do this. You know, you can put a cadence and a rhythm and a beat into a prose line and from a story. You know, it doesn't have to be poetry as such. And
right.
as a consequence of that kind of thinking, Bob Ray, my writing partner, and I, we've come up with an idea that we may have discussed before called the poetics of prose. You know, what can you do to make your prose more listenable? Well,
yeah.
if you're
yeah.
going to do an audio book and you just do flat reading the words, you know, that gets boring, so boring. But if you can bring some
it
of
does,
the poetics
it actually
of prose,
does, though. You know, and if the
yeah.
voice doesn't, it doesn't make you want to listen, you stop listening to the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It,
yeah.
You know, because there's, it makes a difference who reads the book, I think, a lot.
Oh, exactly, exactly. In fact, there was this whole thing that I read. A guy had said that what he really wanted to do was to hear the authors read their work in audiobook. He didn't think that the actors could really get into the
Well,
the
I actually
voice
think
at
that's
all.
A good idea because they have you know your characters and understand them.
Exactly, exactly. So it takes
but
a
I
real
thought
artist.
Of it, but you know, Jack, you know, I thought of it, but it, the truth is, it's not that easy to read your own book only because the breath, it's the breath
yep.
that you take. And
yep.
you can't, you know, a lot of the people think that just anybody could read audiobooks, but the problem is, if you don't have the right breath, you can't do a good audiobook.
Right, exactly, exactly. Well, you know, getting around to audiobooks, I know you have a couple, right? You've done a couple?
Children's books, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Well, one of the things that I know about audiobooks is that we may be coming, the popularity of audiobooks might stem from a number of things, but one of the things that might come around to is the whole history of poetry and literature and stuff. You know,
yeah.
a long time ago, everything was oral. If you look at the great epic poems, you know, the ones that the Basques do and the Epic of Gilgamesh and the European epics and the Japanese epics and all that, they were in an oral tradition. They weren't written down. Even the Iliad, you know, wasn't written till several hundred years after Homer had composed it as a bard, as a poet. So people used to listen to these things all the time. In fact, there's one theory about the structure of the Song of Roland. It's broken into what is kind of like a stanzaic thing. They call them a less, L-A-I-S-S-E. And there's some theory about that, that what the reason that is the way it is sort of like in a TV show today, they say, and last week this happened, you know, bringing you up to date. So the oral poet did that reading of sort of summarizing what had happened before he launched into the new material. So when you get an audio book, it's almost like you're going back to an oral tradition where you listen to the words and you listen to the feeling and all those things, and you don't have to read it, but you're getting it without having to read it. So that's just an idea about the value of audio.
Well, I think, you know, and I think, though, you know, there are a lot of audiobooks out there, and, you know, the problem is that a lot of the books sound so much better than even when you're reading it, only because I feel like even with children's books, they don't do as well as they should as audiobooks, and they probably should be doing better because parents should probably get the book and let the kids listen to the words, because I think I myself tend to skip words when I'm reading, and a lot of people do that. When you listen to it, you hear every last word.
Yeah, Yeah.
It's very different, and I don't know. I think it's great. I love it. But I also know that I have some audiobooks that when I don't like the person reading the audiobook, I can't listen. It drives me crazy. It does.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's a great idea if the, you know, because I've thought of that myself, because I've noticed that some of the people, when they do audiobooks, there's no feeling. And
right.
The author... Yeah. Definitely knows where there should be feeling and where there shouldn't be.
Well, you know, Marcia, I think that it has a lot to do not necessarily with the melodramatic voice, but in fact the emotion behind the story.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you can plug into that in some way, like right now my novel Gabrielle and the Widow is being turned into an audio book by a woman who speaks both Spanish and French, you know. And she's able to get into the Latino characters in my novel without having to go into dialect. You know,
yeah.
I mean, why in the world should you read in dialect? Well, she manages to find a cadence in the words that reveals the character without lapsing into that stereotypical, you know.
Right, see, because I have an issue with that a lot, and I always felt that way when I, you know, when I used to read a lot of screenplays when I was being an agent, it used to drive me crazy when, you know, they were trying to read to make the dialect fit into the screenwriting script, and it just, I think that the actor would be able to do it. So just write what kind of, you know, however, you know, give a little note, you know, to say what you think it should be. But when you start doing that and people are, because every, if you read it, it doesn't sound the same or even right.
Right, right, yeah.
You know, when,
yeah.
that's an issue for her books sometimes. So that's really good if she can do that.
Well, you know, it's like everything else in this new publishing universe. You know, there,
mm-hmm.
everything is in a trial basis. Everything is beta testing. You know,
mm-hmm.
and so we really don't know what works. You know, publishers don't know what will sell. Writers don't know, you know, what the publishers will buy. Readers, you know, may not be there. You know, so it's the same thing with audiobooks as it would be when we were first, you know, publishing our first our first book. What's going on here? We don't know. That whole audiobook thing to me. I have listened to audiobooks, like you say, where I follow along and the reader will skip words. And what that tells me as a writer is, wait a minute, maybe we don't need that word. Because remember, there are always three stories in my view. There's a story that your ego wants credit for. Oh, I wrote that story. That's my story. That's my novel.
Yeah.
And then there's the story
that's inside. Every last word of it. Every last word.
Yeah. There's a story that the characters want to tell, that it this has to be told. You know, that's the compulsion that you get in writing.
Yeah.
And then there's this other crazy story that's already in the reader's head. And if your work doesn't connect with that story, the reader puts the book down and never picks it up again.
Yeah.
But it's like we're engaging this universal story that's already in our reader's head. And it's all because the way the words work. So if a reader is dropping words, it's probably because he or she is locked into the story that is in the reader's mind, and the words are just there as a kind of a stopgap. I don't know.
Right.
Just a speculation.
Well, that's because, you know, that's the other problem. Well, that is one of the problems, but what I see, a lot of people are having books edited by the wrong people. And if you have your book edited by the wrong person, your whole book changes. I mean, forget it. Forget what you wanted to say. I had a woman on the show, and it was on an issue show, and she was very firm in the fact that she decided she was going to edit it. And it probably was she said it may have had a couple things that maybe shouldn't have been there, but she felt because it was a nonfiction book, the people that were editing took out everything that she wanted in the book.
Oh.
And the emotion and the feeling were gone.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, but because you know as well as I do, when a lot of these people edit books, you know, I mean, if the editor doesn't get the author, then it's going to be a bad book. It just is. No matter how good of a company it is, no matter how good the book started and what you meant to say, it's changed. And the good thing, though, about you know, being a if you independently publish it, if you actually know what you're doing, you can get your story out if you find the right person to edit it. If you don't, that's a problem. Because the reader will skip over things that don't belong, and the reader won't understand a lot of it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know,
it's hard.
Like I say, we're in a beta testing phase for the entire writing world, and we just don't know what works, and you have to try all kinds of things until you.
Which brings me to I know you want to talk about something that's very important, which does have a lot to do with what we're saying right now. It's the review. Okay,
yeah.
I quote you. A lot of shows I talk about, because we've talked about reviews, I sometimes say, Jack Remick told me this. But the truth is, this is the killer for authors now, these reviews. This is, and readers too. And readers don't think so, but it's really not in their best interest to have all the, you know, you're reading all these reviews, you might as well forget about the book. Because sometimes they're telling you everything you don't want them to tell.
Exactly,
What would you tell people out there? Because I know that when people are listening on archive, I mean, reviews is a huge issue for people.
Yeah, well, that review business is a real thorny, sticky one, you know.
Yep.
Let's look at it in terms of, I know you don't want to talk about politics, but, you know.
You can.
Our political world is pretty polarized.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty polarized. I mean, we've got... You know, people on the left will not talk to people on the right, and you can't change their mind. Well, you get that same situation in the reviewing world. You know, there are people who like you, and they like your book, and they will write, you know, good things about it. And there are people who, for whatever reason, absolutely hate you, no matter how you've written it. And your book can be the, you know, you get 47 really fine reviews, and this one person says, this is the biggest pile of crap I ever read in my life.
Right, true.
Well, are those other 50 people wrong, or, you know, what's going on? Well, what I tell writers is, first of all, don't read your reviews. And you and I have talked about this before.
Yes,
going to go back and rewrite the book because of the good reviews?
And that's what I say.
That's
what I tell everybody. Right?
Yeah, you know, you don't want to do that. So just don't even read them.
And maybe some of the reviewers should try to write a book, and they would see how it's not that easy. Even to write a bad book.
It turns out the best reviews are by writers who know what they're reading. You know, see, there's that three-story level thing in there, right? I mean, the story the writer wants credit for, there's a story that the characters want the writer to tell, and then there's a story that's in the reader's mind. Well, 9 times out of 10, the bad review comes because the reader has not connected to the story with his own... the novel with his own story, you see, and so it doesn't connect. You know, that's really a bad thing. So the really good reviews are by writers who are readers and understand what they're reading and what's going on and how they have laid down what I call plot tracks and how the objects are working in the books and how the characters develop through time. They look at the long arc and the short arc, you know, stuff like that, all very technical stuff. And I think the good review renders all of that technical stuff in clear, plain language so that a reader reading the review can get a good idea, not just of the story, but of what the writer is doing. See? And if
that is true. But most people, they actually don't, not most people, but some people do not get what some of the stories are. And, I'm not saying that I get, because I don't review books, but let's say, you know, Fran Lewis, she does, her reviews are very long, but sometimes you can use them as a synopsis, and as, you know, that part's, that's a really good part. But what I've heard time and time again from her, from the authors that read the reviews that she's written about their book, she gets what they say. She's a reading expert, but she does get it, you know, and she may put it in a review and other people may not understand what she's writing about, but the author does, because the author, she gets what they're trying to say. But a lot of people, like what you're saying, you're really right, because people don't get it sometimes.
Well, but
and it's nobody's fault, it's just the way it is.
as a writer, we have to be somewhat responsible here. So
well,
is the fact that a certain reader does not get the story or get the book or whatever, is that the reader's fault or is that our fault as writers?
You know whose fault it is? You want to know what I think? I think it's Amazon's because I think the genre. I think once you have to classify a book in a genre, and it may have some comedy in it, and it's a thriller or whatever, because thrillers, I mean, sometimes they have comedy in things. And in romantic comedy, there's some drama in it. And I think once you have to put it on Amazon, it's a killer. Because this is what they say now. I've had authors last week, actually, they say, don't put your book in erotica. But then if you don't put your book in erotica and it is erotic, then the other people get mad. So this is the problem. And they have no choice because if you don't put it in erotica and you can put it in contemporary, I go through this all the time. I switch back and forth. I go in and change it. I don't even know anymore because even when I have shows, that's why I've stopped saying it's a horror show, it's a romance show because – I mean, sometimes I do say it's a romance show, but basically, when you have to categorize it, that's the problem. It's hard to do that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a big issue, actually, because, you know, the Amazon publishing thing, I get when you put up a book, it asks for what category do you want it in, and there is no, you know, there's no fudging in there. You can't say, well, here's an example. Okay.
Yeah, right.
When Trio of Lost Souls came out, my publisher wanted to put it into a literary, I think she said a literary thriller or literary mystery, because it's a literary novel, but it has all the characteristics of a mystery or a, you know,
thriller.
Not a thriller. Yeah. So, but there's no category for that.
Yeah, I know.
So she had to put it in something else. And I remember my first collection of short stories was literary, but it was filed under science fiction.
Why is this science
fiction? You know, well, there are some fantasy elements in it.
See, that's bad. That's bad because that's right, and because you cut your whole market.
Exactly. So they, you know, the industry is setting some sort of a limitation on what you can call your book.
Exactly.
And of course, it has something to do with the way they will sell it, you know, which, you know, categories are, I don't know. You remember there used to be something called a category romance, like there were nurses and teachers and, you know, I don't know if they still do those. Do
I listened to, there was an erotic webinar I listened to, and it was really good, though. But they were saying, like, okay, doctors, lawyers, nurses, if you scuba dive, if you, whatever you do, if you fantasize, if you do anything, put it in erotic because it's okay because erotic readers will read, you can do anything in erotic. But then again, what I heard last week on my show was if you put it in erotica, Amazon puts you further down in a list. This is so bad.
I had no idea of that.
Yeah,
well,
I heard that just last week. And they said Amazon does that. They don't, you know, because a lot of the books, I think Elizabeth Black was talking about, a lot of the books, when you say erotica, you know, that's a category that nobody knows. You say erotica or erotic, okay? And everybody goes crazy. They go, oh, my God, I'm not reading any erotica. But then if you look at a lot of books, they have sex scenes, and that's just the same thing as a book that's an erotic book. So the reader does have no idea anymore because now the writer, she can't even or he can't figure out what to do with her book or him.
Yeah.
We don't know where to classify it.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, that's another aspect of this new universe that we're trying to figure out. You know, everything's still being tested.
And it's not a good way because I think it's confusing. And I think because, you know, after doing, I mean, I've done shows for, I think it actually it's going to be almost 7 years starting like in December. And the truth is, it's so different now, which you know also. It's like it's a whole new world, and I myself get caught up in it with the numbers on Amazon. I go, like, how do these people get to be number 20 or 30? Or thinking, like, what do they do? I can't figure it out. And, you know, we talk about this a lot on the show, and we're not supposed to care about it, but then again we do. We look there. We go, like, wait a minute.
Well, see, here's the thing. One of the things that I, as a writer, encourage other writers, especially new writers that I'm working with, say, look, you've got to get over the need to be loved.
Right.
All right. I mean,
if you can't
get over the need to be loved, you're
right.
always going to be writing for somebody else.
Right,
you know, you've
exactly.
got to let your characters
yep.
tell the story. See, of the three stories, it's the middle one, the ones the characters want to tell that's really important. So if
yep.
you as a writer can get out of the way and let them tell the story, it'll probably work for you. But as long as you're writing to be loved or writing to become a bestseller or writing to, so your mom will read your books or your
yeah.
whatever it is, you know, your need to be loved is overpowering and casting this big shadow over your artistic development.
Yeah,
so it's really important for young writers or new writers, don't have to be
uh-huh.
young, to get over that need and just write the story. Let the characters tell you the story.
Exactly.
If you're really
exactly.
good about it, you'll listen to your characters, and pretty soon you're taking dictation from them. You're not writing dialogue. They're telling you what to say. Now, that's
right.
kind of a crazy thing.
But it's true, though. It is true, and they should take over, and if they don't.
Take over.
Right.
Yeah.
If they don't take over, you don't know your character. Because
you
your,
don't
character
know your character,
should,
right.
you really don't. And, you know, and I have come to the realization that I don't care anymore because I'm writing the best I can. I'm trying to write a good story, but I will say that I do sometimes unfocus. I get a little unfocused because, you know, I have so many guests on. I'm going like, oh, this sounds good, and that sounds good, and this
yeah.
sounds good. But I've decided that I'm just writing the way I write. And
yeah.
that one of the problems for me has always been when you have to have, you know, like all of the, if you want to write an erotic story, you don't have to have that much sex in it. You can have some sex because I find it so annoying when you're writing a scene and you're writing your story and you go like, oh, I guess they got to have sex now. And really, they don't want to have sex now.
Yeah.
It's not interesting.
Yeah.
They need to finish whatever they were doing, you know, and they don't feel like always staying in bed. So you have to move on.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that
yeah.
is the problem. And so I myself am telling people now, just write the story you're supposed to write, just like what you're saying. Write the story. And
yeah,
don't worry
yeah.
about if you don't have enough sex scenes, if you don't have enough dialogue, if you have too much description. Just write the story, and then you'll worry about it later.
Well, you know, this gets us to another aspect of this whole process, and that is, when do you let a story go? All right.
Yeah.
And one of the things that over the years, what I have learned to do is to take the time. If you don't take the time to do it right, then like everything else in America, you have to redo it. And it takes more
right.
time to redo it than it does to do it right. So,
right.
you know from your screenwriting stuff that the first
yep.
draft that somebody reads is not the first time you put pen to paper. The
nope.
first draft in a screenplay and the first draft in a novel is like the 47th version, and you're
no
now confident
way, no.
enough to let somebody
true.
Else read it, right?
It's
to
true.
Me, that's the first draft. You
yeah.
know, that's not the first crank through the typewriter, so to
nope.
speak. This is a
nope.
this is a big, long, involved process. If it were easy,
yeah.
everybody would do it.
Right.
So, you know, one of my colleagues, she's not a student, but she's a colleague. She just got a story. She like is in maybe her late 70s, and she has just written a wonderful story. Let me see if I, you know, I forget exactly, but it's sex, love, and dancing, you know, at
okay.
70 or something.
Good thing.
And she wrote this wonderful story, you know, and she said, I submitted it to six different magazines, and finally one of them got it. And I wrote her back and said, the three words that best describe a successful writer are persistence, persistence, and persistence, right?
Right.
I mean, if you
right.
don't
that's
persist,
it. That's it.
That's
right
what
there.
Gets for negative review. Now, a negative review can also come when somebody first looks at your work that you're in a workshop with, you know, and they say, oh, you know,
yeah.
and pretty soon you find your creativity has been absolutely shut off because you really wanted to be loved, you really wanted
yeah.
them to like that piece, you know, and they think it stinks, and so you're hurt, and you burn out, and you're killed. You know,
and
well,
that's what happens.
You know,
and that's a bad
that's
thing. Very
yeah.
bad.
And the good writer says, oh, okay, and goes home and, you know, persists. You absolutely
yeah.
have to persist. And this is just, you know, a friend of mine.
Well, you know,
just
that's true because,
book.
You know, it's really, you're right about that. Because I there was a book that somebody was reviewing for me, and they gave it a 4-star, and then she thought I was mad at her because she did that. And I go, like, are you kidding? I mean, I have so many rejections on my screenplays, on books and things. I said, it's hard to believe, but I don't care. But I mean that seriously because I've done this so long. I don't care if they give me a bad review, if they reject it. I'm used to it. It's fine. I'll just do something else or keep going on till I make it right. But you can't give up because many people,
look at it in these terms. If you give up, they have won.
I have a good friend
who just published a book of poems called Crossing Over. And I don't know how many poems she had actually written, but she said she had submitted that collection of poetry to hundreds of presses.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until finally the University of Mexico Press picked it up, saw what she was doing, saw what
good.
She had accomplished, and said, wow, let us publish this. And so she did. See, but if she had not persisted, that book would not exist. And so if to any reader or any author or writer or would-be writer who is listening to this show, listen to those three words, persistence, persistence, persistence.
Yep. This is really the only thing that a writer has to do is just keep writing. And, I keep telling people, forget about it if they don't like what you've written. Just keep writing, because not everybody is going to like what you write. And that's just the way it goes.
Well,
if 10 people go to a movie, you may not like the movie. And I may love the movie. Same thing with a book.
Yep, same thing. Exactly. So that whole, that plugging all these things together, how to read a poem, the negative review, going to this whole thing about letting a book go too soon. I have struggled with this most of my writing life, And I know other writers do too. You wrote it and you feel really good about it, and the last critique group said, God, this is the best thing we've ever read in our lives. And so you send it out, and it comes back and says, rewrite chapter 3, or your character dialogue is awful. Well, what do you do then? You see, you've let it go too soon because you haven't really listened to the characters long enough to hear what they were telling you. I mean, they're not going to stand up and say, Jack, that's a dumb line you've given me. Like actors do, they say, I can't say that line. I can't speak that.
You know what? Because you're really right about that. I have a series, Virginia Templeton. I've changed it over with another name, but that's another story. But anyway, but I just realized the other day that Virginia Templeton had a sister. And this is took me 3 years. And all of a sudden I was sitting there, I went like, oh my, I was writing another character, and I went, oh my God, that's Virginia's sister. I went, where did that come from? I didn't know she had a sister, and then I thought, oh my God, she never, in the book, she was always lying to her psychiatrist, telling everybody that her parents were this and her parents were that, and then I went, oh my God, she grew up in an orphanage. And I went,
that's kind of akin to something that happened today. As you know, Bob Ray and I, we work manuscript a couple of days a week. And I had a scene that I had brought, and he was reading it, and he said, this character, Gloria, what do you know about her? And I said, well, I really don't know. I see her as a New York intellectual who knows all this stuff. And he said, where'd she go to school? And I say, oh, that's a good question. But what I had to do, I had just put her in there, but she was kind of a placeholder character. And as a result of his comments, I'll make her deeper, just as you're doing with Virginia's sister.
Yeah, right.
You will find a way to make the character deeper. And, Ellen Gilchrist, in the preface to a book of hers called I Cannot Get You Close Enough, I think it's a collection of connected short stories, she says, make every character in your story strong enough to be the protagonist of your next novel.
Wait, what did you just say? Connector story? That's a good word. Connector story? I like that.
Yeah, connected short. Well, it's like Winesburg, Ohio, a series of stories that are all connected to one another. They're not standalone individuals. Pardon?
Connected story. That's good. That's a good word to put in, because people will understand when you say, this is a book of short stories. This is not a 500-page book. This is,
right.
But connected. That's a good
connected
thing to say, because
short
I have people on. We've been talking about it for the last few months about how people that write short stories, people don't understand what that is. I mean, if you say it's a short story, then it is a short story.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
people
get
mad at short stories, but then don't read the short story if you don't want to read a short story.
Yeah. Well, you
what
know,
do you
short
have to say
stories
about
are
that?
The hardest thing to
yeah.
Short stories are the hardest thing in the world to write. I mean, I'm convinced. I have two collections and a number
yeah.
of other books out there of short stories. But short stories are so hard to write because
yeah.
the important thing in a short story is knowing what to leave out. How much
right.
do you leave out? You know how it works in a screenplay. Implication is everything. You know, I mean,
yep.
you don't have to spell out every single.
That's what I love about screenwriting. Yeah. No,
so in
I
a
love
short
that.
Story, in a short story, it's the same thing. You know, what
yeah.
can you leave out and still not eviscerate the storyline? You
yeah.
know, well, that's everything in a short story has to work at a totally different level. And Bob sometimes says that short stories are like snowflakes. There is no way to write one. They all are the same, and yet, you know, none of them are alike.
Right.
You know, it's wow, this is a,
yep.
a big insight. You know, I'm going to write a short. Well, how do you write a short? What do you
yep.
do? How do you start a short story? Well, I'm going to write a short. Well, no, it doesn't
yep.
work anymore. You know,
I know.
You got to go deeper than that. You know,
I know,
so.
And it's hard. I think it's really hard. It's hard because you have so much more room if you're just going to do a full-length novel. You don't,
yeah.
because in a screenplay, you don't have much room, and that's why it's that way. Because in a screenplay, you like most of the movies that I've been seeing now at the theater, they're 90 minutes. That's it.
Yep.
That's about it. And you know what? Sometimes that's all you need to tell a story. You don't need to have a four-hour movie sometimes. Sometimes you do, but not
yeah.
all of it. Then it's a series, but you don't need it all the time.
Yeah.
And it goes fast, yeah. and well, but see, but while you're watching it, I guess you can see because they can change time by how the person looks. In a
true.
Book, that's a little harder because you know then sometimes
yeah.
if the reader happened to skip a few paragraphs, then the reader goes, well, what happened here? What happened
yeah.
to 20 years?
Well, you
years?
Know that gets us to a very interesting problem here, Marcia, and that is. And I'll just say it this way. What really bothers me is writers who don't write in images.
Yeah.
Now, what I know about perception tells me that somehow our mind, we read an image on a page and our mind sees it. And so when somebody says, oh, I see, they really mean that. I mean, the
yeah.
visual cortex is working. They actually see it. That's why I tell my writers, don't write abstract things, you know. Write concrete things because your reader will be able to decode that. Well, the reader's brain will decode
yeah.
that into an image. And see, screenplays are so interesting because a lot of people don't realize that a screenplay is just an intermediate blueprint for what the director is really going to do.
Yeah.
And the
yeah,
director takes
true.
Those words and turns them into images. You see the image, and once you see it, you cannot unsee it. The problem for the novelist is how to create those images with the words in the first place.
Yeah.
If you don't write in images, if you don't write, you know, it's not, well, Natalie Goldberg used to say, look, it's not a car, it's a Cadillac. It's not a Cadillac, it's a white Cadillac. It's not a white Cadillac, it's a white Cadillac with a red top. You know, I mean, go to the specific in order to create the image. Because if I say, she got in a car, say, what? You know, that's so abstract. But she got in that white Cadillac, the one with the red top, and she
and
was
how
wearing
about
blue
the
shorts.
One, and how about she got in a stolen white Cadillac with the
there
red top?
There you go.
Top.
Well, however you want to qualify,
right.
you see. But the point
yeah.
is you create an image. And
yeah.
so the writer who says, she got in a car and drove off, well, what? Come on. Tell me. Let
yeah.
me see it. If I
yeah.
can't see it, the writing is dead. See, and that gets us to a real problem for the novelist. And especially the newer novelist who gets so hung up in story that they forget that stories are told with action
yeah.
and image.
Yeah.
It's what you see and what they do. That tells a story.
Well, because
you
it's
know.
Such a fast-paced world now, it's like you don't have time for anything. It's like, okay, one, two, three. And that's why you can't write a book, one, two, three. And that's why I see people that have written, like they write a book like every couple weeks. I don't know. I can't do that because I always say, oh, fine, I think I'll be done next week with this story. And that was
yeah.
like 2 months ago. It's like,
yeah.
because I'm not finished because
yeah.
I start writing it, like you say, and then all of a sudden I go, well, this something's missing here. And then you have to, like, wait. It's kind of like you're stirring a pot or something. You have to kind of, like, think about these people.
Well, you know, that gets us to
a really
interesting thing that Bob Ray and I have developed. A lot of people, when you say rewrite your novel, they go gaga. They say, oh, yeah, rewrite. No. Well, I say, then write it as a screenplay. Because if you write it as a screenplay, what you'll have to do is strip away all the nonsense, and you're left with characters doing things and talking about it. See?
Yep.
And then what you do is you go back and adapt your screenplay to a novel form.
That's what I did to That's what I did in Grand Central Station. And, you know, because it was a screenplay. But then when I wrote the book, I actually found such a deeper story than when the screenplay is, because I had time. And it was still a short, not, you know, it's just shorter, but it still had my characters, but they did, they were just a different. And I, you know, and then I felt like I got to know them better. And if I ever wrote it again, I could really write it good.
Stripped,
or if I wrote the screenplay again.
You stripped away all the nonsense and you were left with pure character, and then you put them in motion. See, you know, one of the hardest things, I think Raymond Chandler or somebody said, one of the hardest things to do is to get a character through a door.
Yeah, right.
think about it. You know, how many ways are there to come through a door? You know?
Yeah.
So
are resolved. Remember all the books that were, they were on a train, they went on an airplane, they started it that way so they could, you know. But sometimes I found that if you just start a story in the way you think you're going to start it, you're going to change it later. But start it. If you don't start it, it'll never. You're not going to write it.
That's correct. That's
so you start it wrong, and it comes out right.
Yeah.
Some way. Yeah. I don't know. So isn't that funny though how that is? Because sometimes you get to that point where you've been writing the story, and all of a sudden you go like, well, I think I actually have got it, you know, and maybe I can finish it now because I think I got what really happened. And sometimes you don't know that at the beginning, and I think a lot of writers, they're waiting for the story. You can't wait. It's not going to happen. If you wait to have it all in your head, it doesn't work.
Yeah, one of the things that leads to is when you get the feeling that the story is writing itself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, your hand is moving or you're typing.
Yep.
But really,
yep,
it's almost like you're taking dictation. And that's where I think you've really connected with the characters and what they're saying. And you look at the dialogue and you realize this character would not say that. I've got to fix that. Yeah, I've got to.
Yeah.
And pretty, it's writing itself because you're in the characters, which gets me to one of the major issues that I have with teaching writing is I say, okay, if you're an actor and you have a role and you are a method actor, you get inside that role, you live that role. Well, if you're a novelist and you have a novel with 15 characters, how crazy are you going to be if you're living all 15 characters? Well, you have to let yourself be that crazy. You
well,
know,
that could be me.
That's the villain. That's what I do. That's how it is true.
That is true. You do have to, and when you do write with a lot of characters, you have to do that because each of my characters is always different. So when they're talking, they cannot talk the same way. They don't talk the same way. And I think a lot of times people, I notice that they say, oh, someone used the same word a few times, you know, and I'm going like, if you keep trying not to use the same word, you're not going to get the conversation because sometimes people do say the same thing a couple times in a different way.
Exactly. Exactly.
It just, but I think screenwriting helps. And for me, I think it helped me write. I think I'm actually a better screenwriter than I am a novelist, but it helped me get away from some of the problems that I could never figure out, like going through a door. Because when you first start, you're going like, you're right. You're saying like, well, how do they get through the door? When you write a screenplay, you just write, okay, door, entrance, in, out, whatever, and they're there. And that helps
but
you
in, novel,
in your writing
how
of
do you
novels.
Do it, you know?
I think screenplay writing is a good way to learn. If you hate outlines, that's like an outline to a book.
I do too. I have done all of my novels as screenplays, you know, and then used that as a template for the rewrite. And I've developed with Bob, we developed a technique where you actually, we call it using the cut to technique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like the
Which
story
right
opens
there,
in a train station, you know, cut to the guy in the cab, cut to the guy in his apartment, cut to the guy getting dressed, you know. And what that gives you then is a way to move through your storyline. Then you go back, and somebody once told me that the perfect movie is a silent movie, you know. And so
the one that won the Academy Award, right? It actually was a silent movie. It won the award.
Exactly. So the thing is that what you do is you let the story, you let the images tell the story, you know, and you are then going back, and as somebody said, dialogue last, you know. Don't tell the story in the dialogue. Tell the story in the action and image, and then let the characters react to the action and the image. And that goes back to a notion that Bob and I had when we were first writing the Weekend Novelist Writes a Mystery. Well, what do you do first? You know, which is first? And we realize, well, first there are places, okay? And if you look at Greek drama, first there's a place called the Agon. Then characters come into the place, and they talk about being in the place, or they talk about hating one another. So if you start developing your scene, first a place, a slug line, a place, time, date, and all that kind of stuff, and then the characters come in, and they start to talk. But it's first, you know, action and image, and then dialogue last. And
sometimes you can do a conversation, though, with it, you put two people in a room and hopefully they'll talk. So then, you know, and then you can figure out some of the things by what they say, where they are, you know. I think all
of
those.
Well, but don't you think as a writer, Marcia, especially of screenplays and novels, that the gesture sometimes is as important as any line of dialogue?
Yes.
And, you know, what they,
and
what,
that's the hardest thing to right. That's a very hard thing to get right, you know, in a book, making the right gesture, because then you're going like, well, did this sound right? You know, and sometimes I think what you were saying before is you can't always keep second guessing your characters. I guess you just do it, and then if it's not really what you want, you'll cut it later, because you sometimes you have to know your character a little to know if that's what they're going to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I look at with a character is I ask myself, what does the character want? What's his deeper wish? And what does the character need? Because we're dealing with three things there. What the character wants is an emotional, you know, kind of material process. You know, what the character needs is a deeper psychological thing. And what's the deeper wish? What does that character really want to do? What does that character really want in life, you know? And that's
can send them in the book or in the screenplay to a psychiatrist, and then they can talk to them, and you might figure out what's wrong with them. Because sometimes when they're sitting there talking to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist asks the character questions, you're going like, yeah, you're right. This is what's wrong with you.
Yeah,
it's like people.
Well,
they're people.
Isn't it funny how the psychiatrist has become a mainstay in modern fiction?
Yeah,
you know, if you think about it. I mean, Aristotle, I mean, Sophocles didn't have any psychiatrists, you know, but we've got them. You know, they're everywhere.
We do have them. And
maybe that's what's wrong with us. There are too many psychiatrists.
Right, and when the psychiatrist has issues, they go to a psychiatrist. So that's true, though. And so you're asking someone, but they can't fix their own life, but they can listen to you, and basically sometimes you're just talking and you figure it out yourself while you're talking, and they might not even be listening. Who knows? I mean, you don't know.
Who knows?
You
exactly.
You know, but that's why you know, it does take time to develop. You're right. You know, and that is what I think people – it's a good thing for people if they give themselves time, you know, and make notes. I make a lot of notes. I have more notes, and, you know, and I've been in a movie sometimes, and I'll sit there and write a note because it doesn't come back.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. If you don't write it down, for me it doesn't. If I don't write it down, I go like, forget
it.
It's gone.
Yeah. Let me ask you another question about treatments. When I was working with Stuart Stern and Jeff Miller and Randy Sue Coburn in the screenwriting division at the university here, Stuart used to say that he knew writers who would write a 200-page treatment for a 90-minute screenplay. And in that process, he discovered all of the things about the character, did all the backstory, so that when he began to write in form, it was actually already done. He was just sort of, you know, translating and feeling the process again. Does that strike a bell with you?
See, for me, I'm going to tell you the truth. I hate treatments. Okay, I don't like. I hate treatments because I feel like you're making the characters a certain way and you don't even know them yet. So you're writing it down, and then this is what I think some people can't finish their screenplays because the way they started it, they don't, that middle part is hard to get to. If it's that the beginning and ending sometimes, because when people read screenplays, like production companies, they look at the beginning and ending, and that's why, you know, a lot of the movies aren't that great, because the whole middle, they miss things. But if you're writing a treatment and you're trying to make it happen, sometimes it doesn't when you do the screenplay. And that's the same with the log line. The companies like that log line, and then if the log line, it's hard to do a log line on a comedy because you're trying to make them laugh, and you can't make them laugh in a sentence. Are the problems. So I don't love a treatment, but a lot of people write them, and I think maybe for some people, if you do write a treatment, it might go faster. It's harder to do it when you don't know where you're going, but I think sometimes when you don't know where you're going, you get a better story because you get that aha moment when you go, ooh, this could be working right. I get those a lot, but I don't write them down as treatments. But I think a lot of production companies and a lot, they do like the treatments. But you can't sometimes make the screenplay the same way as the treatment. And that's why then they say, forget it, you're not being hired. You know, we don't like your story. After they like that's the treatment, but they don't like how the screenplay turned out.
Yeah.
Which that is. Then they call someone else in.
Good. So once again, you see, we're back to that good review, bad review things because the world is polarized, you see.
Yep.
You don't like treatment. Stuart really likes treatment, you know.
Yeah.
That's curious. But which gets us to this whole issue, Marcia, that there are as many ways to write as there are writers writing. And there's many ways to do it. So somebody says, oh, take a course in novel writing or you should do this. That's nonsense, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many shoulds and so many gurus. And my new dictum is avoid all gurus, you know, including myself. Don't listen to me. Do what you're going to do and then see what happens.
Well, that's really true, though, because, you know, you see how many emails and this, you know, and write a screenplay in 10 days and do this in 5 days and, okay, go, you know, you can make it work. And, you know, sometimes you just can't make the story work. For me, when I was writing a screenplay, if I got to the page 25, I knew I made a. I have a story. If I couldn't get to the 25th page, I have no story. That's it.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah.
I can't get it. You know.
Well,
you know
George Simenon, the Belgian writer. He wrote in French, of course, but his process, his style was to every now and then he would shut himself away. I think for 2 weeks, and he would write. And sometimes he would write a 300-page novel and sometimes a 50-page book, or a 50-page short story, whatever. But he always, he didn't know what he was going to do until he shut himself away and started doing it.
Yep.
So, you see, it's in the doing that writing becomes, It's not in the thinking, but it's in the actual doing, sitting down and doing it.
Yeah, sitting down.
And so when I was teaching, I'd go in and say, okay, how many of you have written novels? And person raises their hand, say, well, how many do you have? Well, I have 5 novels. Well, how far are you along in your novel? Well, they're all in my head.
Oh,
wait a minute. Wait
that
a minute.
Works.
See,
that doesn't work
doesn't
at all.
Work,
right.
You know, it's the doing is what we're getting to. You know, there was
because
a
that
psychologist.
Is true. That is true. Because people think, they go like, oh, I want to write a book. I go, well, then write it. Then write it.
Yep. Yep,
you know, everybody could say they want to write a book, and that's why when people get a bad review and people, or a bad movie review, people really went to a lot of trouble to write the book. They wrote the movie, and then when they get these bad reviews, it's like poison, and it's so bad for the writer's head that they can't get over it.
Don't read your reviews, Marcia. Read your reviews.
Well, I get good reviews, which is, but I have an issue with I can't keep asking people for reviews, so I'm happy that I don't know a lot of the people that write my reviews because a lot of people, I see what they're doing now. They're right, like, you read my book, I'll read yours, and we'll give you reviews. And I don't do
that.
And I noticed
really
looking
good.
Through your Amazon, you don't have like a million reviews either on everything. Before we go, I want to ask you one question. So if a person is going to have reviews, how many do you think is enough to get them just where they need to be, where they have some reviews?
You know, that's the hardest question you could ask all night.
I
have no idea. One good review. Well, for instance, Dennis Must, who's been on your show a couple
of
times.
I have him written down here because I would like to have him on again. I'm going to have to call him.
Well, he got a sterling review.
I
of
saw that
novel,
review that you put out.
Now Don't Explain and stuff like that, you know. And as a result of that and people coming to read the review and the book and everything, he won some big monetary prize.
Oh, he
which
did
is, you know, a tribute to both his writing and of the perception of the reviewer who found that in the writing. So, you know, one good review can make a huge difference, but if it's, you know, as opposed to 50 mediocre reviews.
Yeah.
See what
yeah.
I mean? I mean, it's reading and writing are such a complex processes.
I agree with you. I do. That's why I don't keep asking people for reviews because I prefer when I see a review that I don't even know the person, which is most of them, I'm happy. Because I know that they're not, you know, swayed one way or another about what I'm like, you know.
You know what I like in a review is if a writer can tell me something that I didn't know I was doing in my novel. You know, and that gets me to the last very. I have to get out of here pretty quick.
Yeah,
I'm going to Portland tomorrow. And
you are? Great.
That, yeah, I got to get out. But that gets to the thing of, you know, in any novel, in any book, in any short story collection, how many stories are there? You know, we don't all read the same story all the time. See, and so if I can find a reader who sees something that I didn't know I was doing,
that's a good way to look at
it. Review.
Yeah.
Yeah, I learned from the review, and I find that far more satisfactory than a dozen reviews telling me the story that I already know. I mean, I wrote the book, you know, I know the story, but tell me something that I didn't know I was doing. In other words,
don't you like it when people talk about your characters? I like that when they ask me about my characters like they're regular people. I love that because I like that they take the time to know my character. That makes me feel good.
Really?
I like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, look, Marcia, I'm going to have to run.
I'm going to go too. It's 9 o'clock at the end of the show, and I want to thank you so much. And you know you're always welcome, but you're a busy guy.
You're very busy. This has been fun, yeah. So I will.
All right, so take care, and we'll get in touch with each other. And yeah, I do want to have Dennis on and Eleanor, so maybe we should have one big show with everybody. That'll be fun. Because you bring great guests.
She's writing herself crazy right now. She's working really hard, and Dennis has got a new book out, too, so. Anyway, on and on. Okay,
right.
Thank
anyway,
you, Marcia.
Anyway, take care.
Thank
have a good trip. All right,
and
I will be on in 2 weeks, I think. 2 weeks.
Very
oh, no,
good.
I'm coming on with Naughty Nights. Naughty Nights will be on in October. So, all right, so take care, and thank you so much for coming on, as always.
All right, thank you.
All right, have a
Talk
great
you
night.
Soon.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.